ANZ Voices welcomes you to the Business of Bluntstock podcast with Tim Rowe and Charmaine Bukovec.
Hello, everyone. It's wonderful to be here for the very first episode of ANZ's Business of Bluntstock podcast, supported by Avesta Bluntstock. I'm Charmaine Bukovec, and I'm joined by ANZ's senior journalist, Tim Rowe. Tim, how are you?
I'm very well, Charmaine, and looking forward to presenting this first episode of the Business of Bluntstock podcast. Hopefully it's not the last. We've put a lot of effort and time and effort into it, and I'm sure people will get a bit out of it.
Yes, Tim, we've been working very hard on this podcast, so hopefully it's not our first and our last. Here on the Business of Bluntstock podcast, we'll be discussing all the latest news and talking points in racing and breeding, while we'll also be joined each week by a special guest. For our first episode, we're joined by the brilliant Henry Dwyer, who has some fantastic stories to share.
He certainly does, Charmaine. We'll then have a regular feature on the podcast called A Share in Success. He will shine a light on some fantastic success stories within Bloodstock. And for our first segment, we're joined by Avesta Bloodstock's Jimmy Onwalla, of course, sponsor of the podcast, an all-round top bloke and Bollywood superstar.
He paid you to say that, didn't he?
I can't. We're above board here on the podcast.
Yes, we are completely above board and extremely professional. Okay, let's get into it. As Tim introduces our first guest, Henry Dwyer.
Two-time Group 1 winning trainer Henry Dwyer started out at Crawford and is now made Ballarat home, where he's forging a career running one of Victoria's emerging stables. Henry trained his first Group 1 winner in 2014 when Sontag, a former Darley-owned and bred horse, won the Queensland Derby of that year. And 2 years later, Precious Gem won the Robert Sangster Stakes in Adelaide to give him his second victory at the highest level. Henry also trained Snitty Kitty to win at Group 2 level in 2017 and has experienced group success with La Falaise and Miss Catherine in recent years. And he now has Group 1 ambitions for his current stable star, Asfura. Henry, thanks for joining us as our first guest on the Business of Bloodstock podcast from ANZ Bloodstock News. Hopefully it's not the last, but we appreciate your time and thought we'd start with just a little bit of a quirky one, the Miners Rest Cup. I've seen a bit on social media and King Island. What is this all about?
Well, firstly, what a pleasure to be with you, Tim, and what an honour to be your first guest. As we spoke about in the preamble, I might be your first and only guest, so we'll see how we go. But the Miners Rest Cup, it's grown a bit of legs. We started with the idea of just going down for a weekend away, and that was the genesis of it, I suppose. We had six of us having lunch at the Provincial Hotel in Ballarat, a lovely restaurant there called Lola, and we thought we'd go for one of our semi-regular catch-ups, and we did. And whilst we were there, John Clearland, the vet down in King Island and a good client of mine, rung up just to touch base and said they were struggling for the races down there and didn't have enough horses, didn't have enough people, didn't have enough interest basically. And I sort of suggested that we might be able to sort something out and get a few horses down there or whatever, and one thing led to another, and we've got six horses down there, one each, and we're going to have a big weekend away on the 20th, 21st and 22nd of January.
Can you explain how it works? I've seen some of these horses of, obviously wearing your Henry Dwyer racing colours, Kieran Maher, Archie Alexander, McAvoy Mitchell colours are down there, Andrew Bobbin, I think there's one other, but I've seen some of them already had a couple of starts, or maybe they're barrier trials looking at the results, hopefully, Henry.
Well, hopefully they're being crafty down there and they're giving them quiet runs, but sadly I don't think they are. I think they're trying their hardest. But so what it's all evolved into is that six trainers, we bought a horse each online, and they're terribly slow horses, but what happens is they're going to go through the season there and have five or six runs, and looking at their first couple of runs, probably not going to get near winning a race, but the good thing is they're all going to race each other on the 21st of January. So one of them's going to have to win, and one of them's going to win the Miners Rest Cup. So we were lucky enough, and I was sort of taken aback a bit by how supportive and how easy it was to get sponsors. Everyone's keen to support us. And so we've got IRT, Lockie Ford and Chris Burke were probably the first sponsors in, and then Sam Matthews jumped on board, and Adam, and they're really keen to support us. Kia Motors, they've got an association with Kira Ma Racing already, so they're Kieran's sponsor. Magic Millions, Barry Bowditch was incredibly, you know, quick to come back to us and say that they're happy to be involved or keen to be involved. Tile Importer, who sponsor a lot of races at Caulfield, they do a lot of business in King Island. They sell a lot of timber and flooring products down there, so they were really keen to get involved. And of course, Ladbrokes, who have got a sponsorship agreement with Taz Racing already, they were keen to sort of tip in a bit of money and get some content for their sort of social media channels, and that serves us really well too, because that'll drive the concept and drive the interest. So the idea was that there's no point just sending a few horses down there and hoping for the best. It was more trying to generate some interest for King Island, and just make sure it's a sustainable racing carnival. They race, I think, 8 times over 8 or 9 weeks over December, January. And if it's just one day, you know, it's not much good to them. But if we can sort of generate interest and get people down there all the other days, it's going to support the local industry. And obviously we didn't really want to be seen as going down there and, you know, cannibalising the joint and taking prize money home. So we're sort of having our own race and all the money goes to charity. So each horse and each trainer and each sponsor obviously is linked to a charity. So, you know, the Royal Flying Doctors Service, the King Island Museum, the King Island SES, King Island Community Help. There's a number of sponsors, a number of charity partners that are going to benefit from the proceeds of these horses. We'd hoped earning more prize money than they are, but ultimately winning the big race, which has a guaranteed pool of probably 20 or 25,000, I suppose, which would go to those charities in proportional amounts, depending on where their horses come.
And the name, the origin of the name, Miners Rest Cup, of course, is sort of the area where the Ballarat Racecourse is, isn't it? That's sort of the origins of it?
Yeah, well, they've obviously already got a King Island Cup, so we couldn't call it that. And then we just, it was just a spur of the moment thing. Well, why don't we call it the Miners Rest Cup, where we train in Ballarat. Miners Rest is a suburb that the racecourse is in. There was a Miners Rest Cup once upon a time, and I might even try and, I've actually bought a trophy already for the Miners Rest Cup this year. It's a plastic crayfish I bought from Taiwan online, and we're going to mount that up on a backboard with a rod through it. And I might have to track down one of the original Miners Rest Cups though, and have a bit of nostalgia to it as well.
And the sponsors, of course, you know, quite a few of them are also good supporters of ANZ, Bloodstock News, Swettenham Stud, and Magic Millions, and IRT, of course, which I think IRT is a good segue into you don't mind going further afield looking for horses, and I believe you've sourced one from Japan.
I have sourced one from Japan. I just think it's incredibly hard to compete these days purchasing yearlings. You know, I don't have a huge budget. I might, you know, I'd say $200,000 is probably top dollar for me to be buying yearling. I might buy 15 or 20 yearlings a year for anywhere between $1,000 and $200,000, but you just get left behind a little bit with the bigger operations buying, you know, 70, 80, 90, 100 yearlings a year. You can't compete with that. But I've always had a particular fondness for stayers and jumpers, because you can really compete. It's not about what they look like as a yearling. It's more about how they develop later on and how patient you are with them. And I just feel like we can be competitive with those sort of horses. And if you think outside the square a little bit, you know, we buy horses from the South Island, New Zealand, which, you know, you wouldn't give two bob for as a yearling because they're so mature, but they do mature up well. And if you give them the necessary time, you can have some nice stayers, as we've seen in recent years with stallions like, you know, even Ghibellines with Smoking Romans this year. And certainly with the jumpers, Raise the Flag, he's probably the premier stallion of jumpers, or sire of jumpers in the Southern Hemisphere over the last few years from incredibly limited books. And, you know, if we can try and source some of them, it's great. And obviously this Japanese one's a new one, but I'm fortunate that my main track rider here, Shiny, he's Japanese, and his best mate is Kozi Kawakami, and they've got a little syndication company called Rising Sun Syndications. And they came to me with the idea of sourcing a couple of horses from Japan. And it is difficult to get them because there is a significant language barrier, which I think we've managed to overcome with Shiny and Kozi. And it's also a travel barrier. It's hard to get those horses back, but there is a direct flight coming back through IRT, our good sponsor, in January. So Cozzy and Shiny have done all the legwork. They've tried to buy numerous horses, and they've got connections with all their track riders and vets and stable staff and trainers over there. And when you're buying tried horses, like this horse is a three-year-old Northern Hemisphere time, so he's going to be four when he gets here. You really need to be trying to get some background on them with injuries and that sort of stuff. And as I said, there is a barrier there with Japan with the language gap. So having them do the legwork is terrific. And we've ended up with a horse called Nishino Crescent. He's our first purchase. He's a son of Satono Aladdin. So there is some parallels with the Southern Hemisphere. Obviously, he stood at or stands at Rich Hill Stud in New Zealand. And so there is a knowledge there from Australian clients to go in the horse of the stallion, which always helps because a lot of the breeding industry over there is a little bit foreign to us. And he's a horse that's, he's had nine starts. He's a nine-start maiden, so don't cut me off now and say I'm an idiot, but I think there's a fair bit of upside there. He's had five placings in, you know, what they call maidens over there, but three or four of those starts have been behind horses that have gone on to win stakes races and place in derbies and that sort of stuff over there. So the form lines are good. He's a nice style of horse. They're pretty savage on him over there in terms of cutting them from their books because they can't have a lot of horses in work, each individual trainer. So if they're not going to be group class horses, then they are keen to move them on. And that's where our niche sort of comes in. We can purchase those horses. And if they can stay a bit, we've got a bit of a market down here for stayers because even though there's plenty of prize money, there's still probably a gap of, you know, staying quality here.
Henry, great catching up. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure is all mine, Charlene.
You talked a little bit earlier about obviously Magic Millions is literally upon us. When this episode goes to air, we'll be in the inspection period. But tell us how you do approach those yearling sales when, you know, you touched on the likes of the bigger trainers having, you know, purchasing maybe 80 yearlings across the season. Talk to us about how you do approach those sales.
I approach those sales with a great deal of trepidation, I must admit. I go there with a limited budget each year slash a minimal budget, of which we're, as with most trainers, well, slash all trainers, we're ostensibly buying yearlings on credit. So I've got a figure in my mind of how many yearlings I want to buy, and I'll go around. I'll you know, previous years we sort of try and buy 20 to 30 yearlings, and we've got a broad cross-section of clients, so we want to be trying to buy yearlings that are attractive to them. I must admit the Magic Millions, it's a great sale, but it's probably a little bit out of my price range for the most part. I as I said before, probably spend up to 200,000, and you're probably not even getting the sale average there. So I generally buy two or three each year of the Magic Millions, but there's a lot of work looking through, you know, 1,100, 1,200 yearlings to be taking, you know, one, two or three home. So I try and outsource a little bit of that to you know, the odd bloodstock agent here or there who give me a list of what they think are nice enough horses that aren't going to break the bank, and just approach it like that. So generally we try and, yeah, as I said, buy two or three at each sale, and then we can give ourselves a chance of selling those yearlings before we have to go to the next sale, because as a trainer, the worst thing you can do is buy 20 yearlings and not have sold a share and put your head in the noose and be yeah, liable for a debt. I'll take you back to a story. Actually, when I first started training, I was young and fresh-faced and probably 25 or 26 years old, and I thought, I've worked in stables and I've worked for a few really good trainers, and I've got some idea what I'm doing, and I think I should start training. So I put the shingle up at Caulfield and sublet a couple of boxes there. I had three boxes, and I went to the yearling sales. So I went to the Inglis Melbourne Premier Sale, and I purchased a filly by Sebring. And yep. Sebring was a young, sort of promising stallion at the time, might have been first or second crop, I can't remember. Went to the sales day office and spoke to, I think it was Michael Kelleher there, who was Andrew Munster's predecessor, and said to Michael, what are we doing here? Are you going to give me some credits? Or he said, no, well, you never bought a yearling here before, so you'll be paying that $95,000 today. And I said, well, not sure we can sort that out today, Michael, but if you give me 30 days, I'm a chance. And so he relented and let me have 30 days credit. And so I did up a little glossy brochure and sent it to my database of about 14 clients or 14 potential clients, and didn't hear much back. And so about 27 days has gone past, and I've sold about 5% of the horse. And I'm thinking, ooh, I might have bitten off a bit more than I can chew here. And I got a phone call from a number I didn't know, and the voice on the other end said, "G'day, Henry, it's Doug Stutt here." And I said, "Oh, g'day, Doug." He said, "You don't know me, but your grandfather," and my grandfather died probably 20 years before I was born, he said, "your grandfather used to have lunch with my father every Friday afternoon at Florentino's in the city." I said, "Oh, that's interesting, Doug. Terrific." He said, "That Sebring filly you bought at the sales." He said, "I'll take it." And I said, "Well, I've sold 5% of it, Doug. What, would you like 10% of it?" He said, no, just the whole thing. I'll take the whole thing." I said, "I sold 5% of it, but you can have the other 95%. "Yeah, no." He said, "Can I have my colours on if I have 95%? I said, "No worries, Doug. You can have your colours on. No worries." And so he transferred the money the next day, and I transferred the money to Michael Keller, and I was away. So she was my first horse. She was a filly called See Me Flash, who went on. She won a couple in town, and she won maybe 3 or 4 races at Sandown, and won one at Sale, and she was good fun, and we sold her as a mare later on. But yeah, that was my first yearling I bought.
I can imagine both the shock and the relief when you got that phone call with him saying, "I'll take all 95%.
And I continue to do it every year times 20 or 30 and put my head in a noose and hope for the best. But that's the tight line you walk as a trainer, and everyone does it, and you got to do it. Otherwise, you don't have any horses.
No, look, I can't say it would be for me. I think I'd be awake at night going, "How am I going to get these horses filled?" So I do take my hat off to trainers for making it work. But you kind of touched on using a bloodstock agent. Obviously, there is a massive catalogue at Magic Millions, but there's a heap of horses throughout that first 6 months of the year. Do you have a preferred agent, or do you kind of use different ones for different sales?
Just horses for courses, but he hates being called a bloodstock agent because he doesn't fancy himself a bloodstock agent. He's more of an advisor. But Merrick Staunton, I have a good relationship with. He purchases a number of horses throughout the year for us, and always sort of picks a nice sort of horse. I think with the yearling sales, if you're shopping in the market, we are, and probably trying to buy horses that are going to take a little bit more time, which is where you get your value. You don't necessarily need as finely tuned an eye, because when you're looking at sprinting types of yearling sale, everyone can pick out a good sort of 2-year-old type. It's easy, you know, just buying a big strong horse that's going to be precocious. Whereas I just, over the years of buying horses, I've just seen horses go through the yearling sales you couldn't possibly like or you couldn't possibly want to buy, but they just furnish and they lengthen out, and those staying sort of horses, as long as I've got a bit of scope to them and a bit of rein, a bit of girth, it doesn't sort of matter anything else. They've got some strength. They can sort of fill out in themselves, and they're not going to break the budget. And you more refer to your pedigrees there as opposed to the yearling, to the type. So we find that particularly fillies we can get a little bit more value with, and particularly, you know, stayers or staying bred horses, and that's what we sort of target. So I don't have a lot of 2-year-old runners. And I don't particularly fancy myself as a good trainer with 2-year-olds, but it just means that we can give them a bit more time, which I enjoy doing. And then if there's a little issue with them at any stage, we can just tip them out, because we're not in a rush to get anywhere, and we're not breaking the bank with the horses, and we don't have, you know, set goals about what we have to, you know, achieve with them. We can just poke along and take our time, and who knows, we might end up with a few more jumpers, Rory.
Henry, every stable needs a flagship horse, and at the moment you've got Asfura, a very good Flying Artie sprinter. And well, first of all, how did she end up in your stable?
Interesting story. To go right back to the very beginning of the story, I had a filly by Artie Schiller called If Not Now When, and she wasn't a bad filly. She wasn't quite stakes level, but she was quite precocious. She won a couple of those Inglis and Vobis gold bonus races at 2 and looked like she might progress to black type. And George Yannis, who is one of the partners in Nora Lane Farm, he had horse sitting at the time, and he said, "What do you think of If Not Now When?" And I thought that she might get some black type at some stage, and her sister or half sister by I'm Invincible was going through the online auction that same week I spoke to him, and he ended up buying her for not much. It might have been 5 or 10,000 or something like that. She was a maiden. She'd had a couple of runs, might have run 3rd in a maiden at Mornington. Which incidentally she actually finished 3rd behind Snitty Kitty, who ties into this story as well through Asfura. But so that mare was called Golden Child. He sent her to flying Artie to create a three-quarter sister to If Not Now When if she was to go on with it. She didn't go on with it, unfortunately. She won probably 250 or 300 grand but never got that black type. And he had a mare called Golden Child Infolder Flying Artie with not a lot of pedigree to recommend it. So he and his father-in-law, Akram El-Fakri, they put her the resulting foal, which was a filly, through the Adelaide Magic Million sale. They had a reserve of 30,000 on her. She was very mature. She wasn't perfectly conformed in front and they couldn't get a bid for her. They had a reserve of 30 on her. I don't think they got a bid and they subsequently took her home. That's where I enter the story. For the second time, Akram rung me up. I had a couple of horses for him and he said, I've got two fillies in the paddock here. They were both passed in Adelaide. I'd like you to take your pick of them. So there was an unencumbered filly there and there was a Flying Artie filly, which ultimately went on to be Asfura. He got me up there and he said, take your pick. And I said, okay, well, that big chestnut filly by unencumbered, she's probably the stronger of the two. I'd be happy to take her. And he said, really? I thought you'd take the Flying Artie. And I said, oh, I'm more of a type man. Like, you know, Flying Artie's an unproven stallion and at least unencumbered's got a few winners on the board and it's a big, strong thing. So, yeah, I'll take that. And he said, no, you won't. I said, well, why did you get me up here to choose? He said, I thought you'd choose the other one. So he said, you can take the other one. So I tried not to have her a couple of times in my stable, but I ended up with Asfura. And from the moment we got her, she was always just the sweetest little filly with the greatest temperament and just knew her job and, she's gone from strength to strength. So kicked off her career in a Colac maiden this time last year and won there. And, she's gone on with the job. She's only been beaten a couple of times, I think, and both victim of circumstance on both occasions. And she's, ears pinned back towards the Oakley Plate in February.
Hopefully we don't jinx you, Henry, and the horse between now and broadcasting this, but you said first up, I read that there's at the aim at the Oakley Plate at Sandown.
Yeah, at Sandown this year. So Caulfield's being renovated. She's won on the hillside track there, so that holds no fears, although she's quite dynamic Caulfield, so that would have been fine too. She's back in work. She had 4 weeks off post winning on Derby Day. We had the option of running her on Derby Day and winning over the carnival or not running there and probably having a run before the Oakley Plate. I didn't think we could do both because, A, time-wise, she needed a bit longer out than that, and B, weight-wise, we needed to keep her close enough to the minimum. So there is an option to run in the Adams Stakes 3 weeks earlier than the Oakley Plate, but I just think for the sake of, you know, winning a listed race, and, you know, they're not to be sneezed at, it's hard to win listed races, but I don't want to be carrying an extra kilo or two in the Oakley Plate. You'd kick yourself if you got beaten in the nose and had the option of not carrying an extra kilo and a half or 2 kilos and you did it. So we'll go in first up. We'll give her every chance. She'll be getting a weight like 52 and a half, 53, 53 and a half, something like that, off her current rating of 105. That'll give her every chance. And, she'll probably come up favourite in early markets and I'd say justifiably so.
It's time to take on the business of Bloodstock Fast Five.
Henry, we've come up with a little, this is Tim's idea, so I'll give him the full credit there, but we've coined a little, a quick fast five section. So, Section? I don't know how we want to call it.
I'm no good at these. You should have given me the heads up here, Charmaine.
It was in your email.
Yes, you should have made me read the email, Tim.
So fast five, look, basically here, give us your initial first thought, which could be interesting on some of these questions. And if you want to fill in a bit on the context, go from there. But first question, or cab off the rank, is what are your early thoughts on your first crop stallions? I believe you have the Autumn Sun filly bred by Tartan Fields in the stable.
I do, yeah. I don't traditionally buy a lot of first season stallions just because I'm trying to buy, as we mentioned before, horses are going to take a bit more time or get over ground, and I feel we can get them for a bit more value. But the Autumn Sun filly, she's a beauty. She's actually out of a Zabil mare, Winning Bell, who she was very versatile. She won from 1,200 to 2,000. This doesn't very sound like a fast five, does it? I'm going into too much detail here, but she is a nice filly. She's got a great temperament. She's back in the paddock, but she'll be a nice filly. And I went through my list before. I don't think I've actually got another first season stallion two-year-old in the stable. So I can't help you much more than that, but I do like the Autumn Sun.
Well, that might sum up that first question nicely then. Tim, do you want to ask the second of the first five?
Yeah, we're recording on a Monday and there's no racing in Victoria on this Monday. Are you a fan of that decision by RV?
Love it. I'm pretty pragmatic in the sense that anything that's good for the industry financially is what we have to do, and I'm all for the more racing, the better in general, and night racing, if that provides a better return, whatever, gets prize money higher. But it is good to have a day occasionally of no racing. It doesn't sound like a lot, and people play devil's advocate and say that, oh, yeah, but you don't have to go to the races if you've got runners, or you don't have to run horses on certain days. But I do follow the races pretty closely, regardless of whether I've got runners or not. And like on a Monday, as we're talking, I just get the chance to sit in the office all day long and just focus on all the logistics and the office work I need to do, which is mainly on a Monday, and without the distraction of having horses going around at Wodonga or Swan Hill or Mildura in the background. So probably purely selfish reasons, but I find it good to have just a day without races now and then.
Very good. That's completely fair, Henry. Next question. Could you end up in a training partnership? And if maybe not, or maybe if you would, who would the person be that you picked to end up in said partnership?
Probably not. I'm probably too stubborn and unable to work with other people. I think probably my grade two report said that when I was in primary school, and not a lot's changed since then. But I think if you're going to do it, you got to do it with the right person. You know, there's plenty of people that I get along with well and plenty of good trainers out there, but I don't really want to have more horses than I've got in work, so I probably don't need that. I've got, you know, 45 horses in work and I've got a young family. I don't really need the hassle of having more staff than that and more horses than that. It takes a lot of doing, even having 45 horses in work, and I think if you need to go further, you probably would look down that training partnership line. I've got an assistant trainer in effect here, Simon Morris, who's a very good trainer in his own right, and he helps me out a great deal. I don't really see the need to go into a training partnership at this stage, but I think they are terrific for work-life balance, but there is a bit of work that needs to go into finding the right person. I think the ones that work well are the senior-junior sort of combination, whereby, you know, you see a senior trainer that takes on a junior partner and there is still that, I suppose, that hierarchy. And it's not it is a partnership in the book, but it's just a junior learning from a senior and sort of effectively succession planning into taking over their stable, I suppose, which works really well. But, at this stage, not for me.
Henry, you promised you'd give us something controversial. It'll go mainstream, possibly the back page of the Herald Sun or something. As we're speaking, not long before was the whip, controversial whip protest in Victoria. Blake Shin on My Yankee Girl was, I guess, relegated to second. What are your thoughts on the whip rules?
Oh, look, the rules there, I think it's terrific that they upheld that protest, because if you're going to have a rule, there's no point not enforcing it. I don't necessarily agree with the rule. I don't really know. I'm sort of undecided on it, but if you are going to have a rule and just hit them with a wet lettuce leaf, if they break the rule, then there's no point having it. So until they start, you know, upholding protests or disqualifying horses, I suppose, that breach the rule, the whip rule, it's, you know, a couple of grand fine or a few days suspension here and there is not going to stop anyone in a big race, is it? So I think they've done the right thing in that sense. In terms of the rule, I think it was set up to, I suppose, improve the visual sort of, you know, of horses not being flogged in the last 200 metres, and times change, and I'm all for that. I think, you know, if we look back on racing the 80s and you see a video of Mick Dippman whopping the fur off one for the last 600 metres, that's just not socially acceptable anymore. And, you know, not that we're anywhere near that stage at the moment. You know, the riders are very responsible and respectful of society, I suppose, and we use padded whips and that sort of stuff. But I think having some sort of restriction is a good thing. I'm not sure we're at the right level now where the restrictions are right. I think when you're saying they can have open slowly the last 100, but they're restricted before that, I would have thought surely it's the last 100 when everyone's watching the race, and when everyone sees the replay, that's when you should be restricted. But that's for greater minds than me to work out. But I do think there is a place for restricted use of the whip, and eventually maybe no whip racing, or just carrying a whip for safety. That's I think it's the end game. That'll happen, whether it's next year, 10 years or 100 years, there will be a stage where we don't have whips in racing. And I think this is just a graduation towards that. But back to the point, I think the protest should have been upheld on the current rules, and it was, so that's good.
Finally, Henry, if you had a, I'm not going to say choice because that means, that sounds like you're being held hostage, but in an alternate reality, prefer to be a trainer or a Channel 7 racing commentator?
Well, the choice was probably there, Charmaine, and I chose to be a horse trainer. It was a great little sort of 18-month period, but it coincided with COVID, so it worked out really well that I could do that on Saturdays and there was no owners at the races. So if I wasn't at the races, nobody really turned a hair. The problem became when COVID finished and I was still doing it and I'd have runners on a Saturday, the horses would turn up. And if the horses win, nobody cares where you are or what you're doing. You've done your job, the horses won. It's when the horse performs poorly and you're on TV making an earn through another sort of sector, the owners can get a bit disgruntled, and probably rightfully so. I can't make them go any faster by being at the races, but I can certainly hold the owners' hands when they perform below expectations. And a lot of the job is expectation management, and you've got to be there to soften the blow if they run poorly. And I just wasn't in a position to do that if I was going to be on Channel 7. And by the same token, as I said before, I've got a young family, and I'm time poor as is. Any horse trainer's time poor, and if you can't sort of be home enough, but then you find a day to be doing Channel 7, it sort of doesn't reconcile too well. So I just made the decision. It probably didn't have the time to do it, and it probably wasn't the best thing for my business, but it was a great experience. I had a great time, learning from absolute professionals. One week you're there with Bruce McAvaney, and another week you've got Hamish McLaughlin and Jason Richardson, and it was very enjoyable. It was a fair bit of effort involved. There's a lot of planning that went into it on the day before, and it was a full sort of day and a half a week. As I said, I just didn't have time to do it, and it was enjoyable though.
Some fascinating stories from Henry there, Tim, and what a great first guest for our podcast.
We now move on to our next segment, Share and Success, where Charmaine and I chatted to Avesta Bloodstock's Jimmy Onwalla.
A Share in Success, shining a spotlight on ownership success stories with Avesta Bloodstock.
Jimmy, thank you so much for joining us here today. You're joining us all the way on your holidays from India.
I am actually, yes, a very relaxing holiday, but looking forward to coming back to Australia for Magic Millions. So
good. I'm glad you're not going to miss that. It's a very important sale. Jimmy, thank you again for joining us. And very special mention, you are supporting the Business of Bloodstock podcast through your company, Avesta Bloodstock.
Yeah, look, it's very exciting for me too, like, as someone who is a part of the horse industry, I do like to sort of play my part in a small way with stuff like that. And I do like things that are innovative. I like things that are new. So always happy to get behind a good cause, especially with a good team like you guys have.
Oh, Jimmy, you're being too kind now. You don't get brownie points for that, by the way. but we're launching a segment. So you're obviously supporting the overall podcast, but we're also launching a segment called A Share in Success. This segment is going to run for 20 weeks, and it kind of fits your business motto quite well. So small investment for big results. So it's, the next 20 weeks, we're going to engage with some guests to hear about how they might have had a 5% share that has completely changed their life. So before we hear about your share in success, tell us about Avesta Bloodstock.
Well, in a nutshell, Avesta Bloodstock was basically like the company was registered for the first time in 2017. I've always traded stock since I came to Australia. So let's say since 2009, when I first came to Australia, I've always had small shares in horses here and there, and I should trade, but I never really ramped it up. But I think it was in COVID when I was working for Aquis, and when a lot of restructuring was going on with Aquis, and I knew that there would be a time when I was going to go out on my own. And that's really when I ramped up my own business. Like Avesta Bloodstock is basically a sole proprietor business, which is owned 100% by me. But I think I got momentum when I teamed up with a lot of people and started investing in Bloodstock. And I never did that really as a way to generate funds to get bigger. I just wanted to get more quality, but get smaller shares with a few different people. And more than invest in horses, I thought I should start investing in people. And that's pretty much how it began. It's been a very good, I would say the last 2 years have been very kind to me. You know, we've had a lot of success. I presume that's come because we've managed to buy stock quite low in the market. You know, it's been tough for people selling horses in that COVID year, but luckily we had the funds to go and buy them. So I think it worked out really well for me.
And I think, you know, Jimmy, you have had some great results. So to kick off a share and success segment, tell us about your share and success.
Well, there have been a few horses that I would say have really kickstarted it for me, but I think where it really began was in the year 2015. I was sitting at the Magic Millions National Sale because I'd gone there to buy a broodmare. And mind you, I didn't have much money behind me. You know, when I first came to Australia, I started on 48 grand, you know, just that was on my salary. And then by the time you pay your rent and you pay your bills and your car, you don't have much left in the bank. So I went there to buy a broodmare and I was blown out of the water because the market was so strong. And a High Chaparral yearling filly came through the National Yearling Sale. And she was really, really well-bred and Coolmore was selling her. And I was just sitting there and, you know, she came in the ring and she was on $7,000. And I didn't know what to do because I really wanted to buy her. But the reality was I didn't even have the $8,000 in my bank to buy her. But I bought her anyways for $8,000 I bid. And then I panicked because I didn't know what to do. And so I called a good friend of mine, Dustin Khan, who used to work with me at Dali. And I just told him, I said, look, man, I found this filly and I think her family would improve in the next year and a half of 2 years. And he goes, oh, but, you know, we were supposed to buy a broodmare, not a yearling filly. And I said, well, that's all I could find in the whole sale. And anyways, he jumped in with me and he never said no. And I really needed a partner. And the next thing, you know, she became half sister to Sacred Eye. She won, you know, she won a group three. Tulip became the other half sister to her who ran third in the slipper. And anyways, we ended up selling her for $280,000 at the chairman sale a couple of years later. So, you know, I think that's really what got me going. And in a way, when you buy something and you back yourself and it turns out well, I think that gives you the push when you do it with your own funds to go and try and do it a bit bigger and better. So I think that's where I think my success first came. You know, that's the story that at least with me, it resonates with my motto. If you don't have to spend top dollar, you can just have to be a bit shrewd and buy what you believe in.
Tim, you've got a few questions to ask Jimmy now.
Yeah, Jimmy, obviously I've observed the way Avesta Bloodstock's evolved over the last couple of years. To me, it seems like you seek safety in numbers, or is that part of the way you approach your business and your partners involved with you?
Tim, I would say it's not really how I originally planned it, but I think my experience working in nominations with Dali and with Aquis actually showed me breeders on a very large scale. Like, you know, you rarely work a job in this industry where you can come across portfolios that you can see so in depth, and you can see. I'm not saying you can't do it with small numbers, but what I'm saying is it's really hard to do it with small numbers, and you need a lot of luck because, as all of us know, in the horse industry, there are factors beyond our control. You know, the environment. You know, you can have a broodmare band of five horses, and you know, if your best or your top lot gets hurt and is not saleable, you're pretty much trying to break even. So that's what inspired me to try and basically sort of find safety in numbers, because I thought if you spread your risk across a lot of horses, I think you sit a bit better. You always need a good result with them either. It doesn't matter, you know, you can have numbers and still have a bad year sometimes. But I do find safety in numbers works for me, at least, because the way we invest in horses, you know, the more you have, more smaller shares in a lot of horses works a bit better for cash flow for me.
Jimmy, I've been fortunate enough to go around the sales with you, spend an afternoon with you at the Gold Coast and look at yearlings on this occasion. Mm. But you know, it's always fascinating. You've got numerous bloodstock agents and trainers looking at the same horse and they all see something different, which is the beauty of it. It's an opinion game. But what where this is sort of, you know, the Gold Coast is upon us. Mm-hmm. What do you look for in a yearling?
I think if I'm looking at a yearling, there's two ways to look at it. If I'm looking to invest in a couple of colts to race, I am looking at horses that are really mature in January, because, you know, it's two-year-old racing is where commercially the real money is. And for someone like me, I do it as a business. I'm not doing it to have fun going to the races and having a share in a horse for myself or for people that invest with me. You know, it's very, very business oriented. So I think for me, what I'm looking at a yearling is, of course, you know, everyone looks for good muscle and good movement or everything, but I'm looking more at maturity. I am pretty forgiving of confirmation in younger horses. And I'll tell you why I'm forgiving is, you know, normally you want a horse to be well conformed because you want that horse to race on, you know, for a long time. But in Australia, if a horse is really good, 2-year-old or a 3-year-old, it's retired at the end of the career anyway. It's not that it has to run 30 or 40 times and be completely sound to do it. So if you're looking at a horse who's going to have maybe 8 starts as an average in his career, and if he wins a group one, he's going to go to stud, I can forgive a bit on confirmation. But maturity is something I'm very keen on, because that horse has to be up and running, you know, by September, October, November for the 2-year-old trials. You want a horse that is really forward. And if I'm buying a filly as a future broodmare prospect, I can almost forgive everything. As long as she has ovaries and a uterus, I think I'm happy, you know, as long as I like the pedigree of that filly. So I'm pretty forgiving. In fact, I do try and look for fillies at most yearling sales that probably have certain conformational defects or an X-ray issue, because you can really get a good discounted price for a future broodmare. And I don't mind holding them for a couple of years to get there.
Weanling, pin hooking, we see a lot of people doing it, and, you know, I get to report on it. It looks easy. You see the results and go, look at how much money they've made. But Avesta Bloodstock has had some success, and I know, I'm sure there's some horror stories as well. But sure. How do you go about it, and how have you experienced success? Because you have found some nice weanlings and turned them into a decent profit.
Yeah, look, pin hooking, it's really hard in the sense that, you know, you're trying to predict the future with a product, and, you know, and anyone would tell you horses change so much on you. You know, you can buy a horse with absolute clean set of X-rays, and you can probably find something that's gone amiss in the next 4 or 5 months. It does happen. You know, it doesn't happen that often, but it can. And also it's the unpredictability of the market, because, you know, the horse market is that fickle minded that what they like in May or June of the year, in come January Magic Millions, that stallion could be dead in the water, or you know, they've just gone off the horse. So yeah, it's pin hooking is difficult. And I do find, at least with pin hooking, it's better to team up with a few different people and really spread your risk among stallions. You know, try and get a couple of proven horses, a couple of first season horses, maybe a couple of stallions just on the cusp of maybe making it or not. But I think it's because of the nature of pin hooking, where you're trying to see, you know, a horse when it's 5 or 6 months old and thinking how he'll furnish, you know, eventually. So it makes it a bit hard. And I think that's why I rely a lot on information or bit of pointers from people that work with those horses at stud. Luckily, in my position, I know a lot of people that work hands-on with horses, and they're the best people to tell you what they've seen with that horse, you know, since he was born, you know. So I think it helps, you know. So those small 1%ers that you can get in this game from your friends and people that work in the game really help.
I guess talking about young people, Jimmy, what is a piece of advice you would like to give to someone who may want to get into the bloodstock side of the industry and, you know, doesn't know how or doesn't have that money?
I think at the end of it, if you're working in the horse industry, I do believe, and, you know, everyone has their opinion, I guess, but I do believe you don't really get the feel for what you do unless you have your own skin in it. And, you know, whether you buy a broodmare, you pin hook, or you have a share in a racehorse, till you don't spend your own money, I don't think you really get a feel of the ups and downs and the emotions that run through you. And look, what advice would I give if you're starting in the horse industry? I always say be thick-skinned. Don't get disheartened, because it is a tough game. And I'm a sort of a person that if I was giving an advice to a 20-year-old, I would tell them that, you know, you'll only be 20 once, you know. you know, don't worry about saving money for a house or, you know, this and that, because eventually you have your whole life to do it, you know. But you'll only be 21, so you'll only have your chance to, you know, invest in stock and try and make it big, you know, once in your life when you're young, you know. If I could change anything about my life, I would want to be 10 years younger. And that's not for my looks or my wrinkles. It's because I would have done things differently. You know, I'm 37 now, and I started a bit late because, you know, when I came to Australia first, I really wanted to get a very good grounding. And I basically wanted more knowledge, because when I grew up in India and I came into the horse industry, I was always behind the eight ball in a way, because, you know, I wasn't born into a horsey family per se. Like, my mom raised a few horses, but compared to a lot of other people, they're way more talented, you know, hands on with horses and, you know, with what they do, you know, with animal husbandry. So for me, it was a learning curve every time. I had to learn, whether I went to my university in America, even on the flying start. I think there were 12 of us, and I'm happy to say I probably was the least experienced at the end of it. You know, when I came on the course, I saw my other fellow students. They were really, really, you know, they knew what they were doing, and, you know, they'd been doing it for years, and, you know, there were boys and girls that rode horses when they were 4 and 5, and I was like, geez, you know, I just had to get on the horse for the first time in my life, you know. But I've always liked the business side of horses, so I would say, if you're young and you're keen and you're enthusiastic, be a bit thick-skinned. Don't worry about investing in a house or a car, you know. Try and get into the game, and that's the only way to do it, you know. Have a bit of skin in the game, you know. And if you know, whether it's 5% or 50%, doesn't matter. Whether it's a 5 grand horse or 50 grand horse, it really doesn't matter. But try and have your skin in it.
Thank you, Jim. I think that is good advice. I'm just going to say to all those 20-year-olds, this is not regulated financial advice. So please,
yeah, it's not. Exactly. It's just my opinion. You know.
Yes, opinions only here, not actual financial advice. But Jimmy, I think, you know, that's such the importance of this segment is, you know, I think if we were all 10 years younger and we had someone say, "This is how I got my start," or "This is how I would like to do it," I think that's where this segment is going to be really crucial to encouraging people to go, oh yeah, I can do that.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. You know, that it's about also, I guess, motivating people, because I do find, like, when I, you know, when I walk around the horse sales, there are a lot of people, a lot of young people that I've known for a long time, and, you know, they still haven't bought a share in a horse, and they always contemplate, oh, and they do say, oh, it's so hard and it's so expensive to get you know, get a horse. Yes, I do know it does cost money. It's not free, you know, but if you team up with people, there's no shame in taking a small share in a horse, you know. Like, even if it was 10% in a pinhook, do it, you know. You start somewhere at the end of the day, you know. And, you know, that's where you build up from. So that, at least that's what I did. So I can put my hand on my heart and say, you don't need to have your millions behind you when you start. You know, you can pretty much have nothing. But yeah, you gotta take a chance in your life somewhere.
Yeah, you gotta start somewhere, definitely. 100%. No, I think that's good advice.
Charlene, it's the end of the first Business of Bloodstock podcast. We'll be better for the run, I'm sure, but it's great that we've got there, and hopefully our listeners got something out of it.
Amazing, Tim. From an idea over beers to it forming into a reality. What an amazing first episode. I'm really excited to hear how everyone reacts, and looking forward to doing this again with you next week.
Absolutely. We'll have plenty to talk about with the results of Magic Millions, and hopefully we can get a few industry people on the podcast.
Definitely. I'm looking forward to next week, and Magic Millions, here we come. Well, we're kind of already here. Looking forward to a great sale for all our breeders and vendors. I'm sure they'll do absolutely amazing. So I'd like to wish them all the best. And if you see any of us around the sales complex, come and say hi. We're always happy to have a chat or a beer, depending on what time of day it is.